In this Friday edition, we share a segment from the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism on the race for a COVID-19 vaccine.
In a matter of weeks, a coronavirus vaccine probably will be available. October could be the month, according to President Trump. Or maybe not, if you listen instead to one of the president's top scientific advisors, Anthony Fauci, MD. But whether an initial vaccine is ready this fall or in early 2021, the speed with which it has been developed and the novel technologies deployed along the way represent a game changer. Today, we'll be learning just how different this vaccine is from prior generations of vaccines, when it might be ready, and who might benefit first from it. Questions and story possibilities abound, ranging from whether trials will be conducted properly without undue speed, to whether the U.S. plan to distribute the vaccine, just released today, will be successful, to whether enough Americans will trust the new vaccine enough to take it in, and ensure that enough people will allow us to have what is known as herd immunity. Here to help us understand all this, we have Umair Irfan, has been covering COVID-19 full-time since the pandemic emerged. He usually covers climate change, energy, and the environment for Vox. He's also a contributor to Science Friday. Before joining Vox, Umair was a reporter for Climate Wire and E&E News in Washington, D.C., where he covered health and climate change, science, and energy policy. And now let's get started and turn to Umair, who's going to walk us through the science behind the vaccine.
Great. Thank you, Michelle, and thank you to the Center for Health Journalism. Let me just get this started. Great. My name is Umair Irfan, and I'm a staff writer at Vox. As Michelle said, I did a bit of a turn here right at the beginning of the pandemic, switching from climate to covering this, global catastrophe. What I've been doing is writing big picture explainers about the pandemic, things like how the immune system works, how a vaccine functions, and then some of the ins and outs of that. I don't proclaim any unique expertise in this area. This presentation is built on some of the things that I've learned over the past few months and just how I see things potentially shaking out in the future. So just to outline the presentation, I'll just break it down into three sections. First, I'll talk a little bit about the technical aspects of a vaccine. I'm sure many of you are familiar with these aspects, which is why I'll keep it brief, but I think it's worth having this context because it helps explain the next section, which is what's unique here about the COVID-19 pandemic and the race for a vaccine here, particularly aspects like how fast it's going, some of the unique technologies that we're developing, and the scale at which we will need to be vaccination campaign. And this is where I'll spend the bulk of my discussion. So the basic thing to know about vaccines is that they're engineered to cause an immune response without causing a severe infection or illness. Vaccines can and do cause mild symptoms, and there are also some serious side effects that can lead to some serious complications. However, those complications are rare because vaccines are rigorously tested. Since they're administered to hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, even rare complications get magnified. A 1 in a million outcome will occur 330 times in the US if we were to administer a vaccine to everybody in this country, which is why we have to work very hard to get the rate of complication lower than we would for other kinds of drugs or other kinds of pharmaceuticals. And since vaccines are administered to people that are healthy, there's a less of a tolerance for side effects, and they're also given to people that have pre-existing conditions. So we have to work around those complications as well. Another thing to remember about vaccines is that, well, in addition to the higher bar for immunity, they use a lot of different tactics to generate immunity. There's a lot of different approaches. Right now, we have about 200 vaccine candidates under investigation all around the world. We've got about 9 in phase 3 clinical trials. Some of them have some overlapping techniques, but they're using a smorgasbord of just different techniques and tactics to try to generate immunity to this. And then finally, one thing to remember is that a vaccine is not just something we take as individuals. It is something that benefits us all the more people take it. I benefit when I get vaccinated, but I also benefit when you get vaccinated. And somebody who isn't vaccinated gets a benefit when everyone around them is vaccinated. And this is the idea behind herd immunity. There are going to be some people that are fundamentally unvaccinatable because they have some kinds of immunological conditions, or we may not be able to reach them with a vaccine. They benefit from protection when everyone around them is protected. And that's a big part of the public health strategy for how we distribute vaccines. And that's kind of what sets them apart from other drugs. But if there's one thing to know about the immune system, it's this. The immune system is very complicated. T cells are not the whole story. Antibodies are not the whole story. Antibodies plus T cells are not the whole story. The whole story is a very complicated, boring novel with too many characters. But it's important to remember that there's a lot of different factors that constitute immunity. The B cell response, the T cell response, the antibody titers together, those factors, when they render immunity, are known as the correlate of immunity or the correlate of protection. Right now, we don't know what the correlate of protection is for COVID-19. What that means is we can't simply inject somebody with a vaccine and look at their biomarkers and determine whether or not they are immune. That's why we have to put this through the paces of clinical trials. We have to actually test this vaccine in the real world against the actual virus to make sure it offers protection. This is a time-consuming and very expensive process. For most vaccines, this is a big reason why vaccine development efforts take decades. Now, as I said earlier, vaccines use a variety of different approaches, sort of the conventional tactics for developing vaccines and some of the vaccines that use them, the things like the live attenuated vaccine, which is basically a weakened form version of the pathogen, or the inactivated vaccine, which is a dead version, a subunit, which is just a portion of it, and a toxoid, which is the toxic waste or the toxic byproduct of a pathogen. In general, the more closely a vaccine can imitate its target, the stronger and longer lasting the immune response, but not always. There's always different viruses just have different functions physiologically, and those are difficult to account for. And another thing to remember is that the immune system can also overreact. With COVID-19, some of the serious complications we see are not damaged by caused by the virus itself, but by the immune response, by the immune system going into overdrive and causing a lot of collateral damage. So with a vaccination effort, we want to coach the immune system to be able to combat the virus should it appear, but also not so much that it does more harm than good. It's a very fine balancing act. So a big part of what's unique here is the pace of progress. Why? For one thing, researchers around the world are cooperating with one another at unheard of levels. Scientists are a bit competitive and they're territorial, yet researchers from around the world are teaming up, private companies, public universities, they're all sharing notes, and that has definitely accelerated the development process. Another key factor here is how many resources are being poured into this endeavor. Vaccines typically take a long time to develop, which means they make a very poor investment for private companies. A lot of vaccine research on previous drugs has stalled, including past coronaviruses like SARS and MERS, because there just wasn't a good enough market for it, or those disease outbreaks faded away before a vaccine could be completed. But now governments, philanthropists like Bill Gates and businesses are pouring billions of dollars into this endeavor. There are also groups like the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovation, CEPI, that was born out of the vaccine development effort for the Ebola virus. And that effort was stalled repeatedly because the outbreaks of the Ebola virus were sporadic and they were occurring in poor countries. And so a bunch of researchers and philanthropists got together and said that they wanted to have a mechanism for continuously funding vaccine research, even if it shifts off of the public health radar. And there are now several governments and initiatives that are paying for vaccine development, even building supply chains and manufacturing capabilities for vaccines prior to them gaining approval. That means that while we're testing them, we're also building factories for making them, with the expectation that some of those vaccine candidates will not come to fruition. And another thing to talk about, again, is to emphasize on the pace side. Within 2 months of getting the genome sequenced of the COVID-19 virus, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, a company, Moderna, which we'll talk about in a moment, injected the first human with its vaccine candidate. That's absolutely bonkers fast to go from not knowing anything about a virus in 2 months to having an actual vaccine possibility is crazy. And that's in part because of the new technologies that we're bringing to bear on this. And the other factor is that we're overlapping clinical trials, the phase one and phase two in particular, we're running those concurrently, and that is helping us speed up the development process. However, we've just talked about COVID-19, the vaccine development effort, as a race. Some scientists bristle at that. Clearly, there's a time element at work, and really there's a clear urgency when thousands of people are dying and millions are infected. Those are established in early phases of clinical trials, but they have to be reestablished on larger and larger swaths of the population, including people with, immunological compromised systems, and also people with underlying health conditions and so on. And also the first vaccine to get FDA approval will have to clear a minimum efficacy benchmark. But beyond that, there's very likely to be a continued jostling among the vaccine candidates for effectiveness. The first vaccine candidate we get that gets approval may not be the best one. It may not be the ideal one. Very likely, we will also need more than one type of vaccine for different groups of people, for, you know, different immune conditions, as we mentioned. And also, finally, a vaccine is not a magic end the pandemic button. Just having a vaccine doesn't let us get back to normal. We have to look at the correlate of protection. We have to look at how long immunity lasts. Ideally, we're aiming for high efficacy and long-term protection. But short of that, we may end up in a situation where we have to revaccinate people or give boosters in order to effectively contain the pandemic. And in the meantime, we're still going to be needing measures like social distancing, like wearing masks. Those are critical to how we deploy vaccines because they keep transmission low, which allows vaccine distribution to be more and more effective. And that's also why some scientists really hate the term Operation Warp Speed. They think it adds an unnecessary element of speed that can actually be counterproductive. This animation comes from the New York Times and from a fantastic article that kind of highlights just what I was describing in the last slide. So the bars in the initial phase you see is basically how clinical trials of vaccines and development effort work. You can see that each stage is actually sequential. Like you have to finish pre-laboratory testing, then go to phase one, then go to phase two, then go to phase three, et cetera. But what we're doing with COVID-19 is that we're, again, not only shrinking the amount of time we spend in each phase, but we're overlapping them. And crucially, if you look near the bottom, the manufacturing is already taking place. We're already building factories for manufacturing vaccines, even though none have gotten full approval. So one of the other key factors here that makes this the hunt for a COVID-19 vaccine so unique is the fact that we've got new technologies. Recall what I said earlier about conventional vaccines. Those involve using structures of the virus. And that's the approach that we've been using for pretty much centuries since the Edward Jenner vaccine for smallpox. But now we're looking at ways not just imitating the structure of a vaccine, but imitating how it functions. Different people have different category definitions, but the way I divide this is that the prior generation of vaccines, I consider those to be structural vaccines. And this new generation of vaccines, I call them genetic vaccines. These are the approaches being used by companies like Pfizer, Moderna, AstraZeneca, and Oxford. And these are probably some of the biggest revolution in vaccines in more than a century. So this diagram highlights the approach by Moderna. This is a company that's already in phase three trials. I'll use this as a case study, but understand that not every genetic vaccine works the same way. There are some important differences between them, but I'm just using this as just sort of an example. Moderna has an mRNA vaccine, and in this diagram, I mean, it looks complicated, but we'll just focus on this part here. So what they do is that instead of starting with the structure of the virus, these genetic viruses use instructions for making the viruses. And these instructions can be coded in DNA or a related molecule called RNA. And Moderna is using mRNA. And compared to DNA, RNA is a very short-lived molecule. It's broken down very quickly in the body. But Moderna claims that they developed their vaccine without ever having to handle the live SARS-CoV-2 virus. And they said a sample of that virus never entered any of their facilities. Instead, what they did was they used the genome of the virus that was posted online by Chinese researchers back in January. And then within 2 months, they were able to sequence that genome and use the portion of the genome that they were interested in and start building their vaccine around that. So one key advantage of this approach is that it's very modular and that it's very fast. In Moderna's case, they use mRNA. And the mRNA segment here codes for the spike protein of the virus. The spike protein of the SARS-CoV-2 virus is what it uses to dock with cells. It engages with the surface proteins of a human cell. It enters the cell, and then it begins replicating, making copies of itself before bursting out. So that's the viral replication life cycle. The logic here, though, is that by creating the spike protein inside the human body, the immune system can recognize that as a foreign invader and start building its immune response around it, particularly making antibodies. And these are proteins that can attach to the spike protein and prevent it from docking. And the idea is that once you have you teach your body how to make these antibodies, if the virus does infect you, it can effectively produce these antibodies and prevent the docking to take from taking place. The problem is that the human body tends to treat free-floating RNA and DNA as hostile. The body just generally doesn't like it when things are in places where they shouldn't be. RNA is only found in the cell's cytoplasm and in the cell's nucleus. DNA is only found in cells in the nuclei of cells. And so a body starts seeing strands of genetic material floating around outside, it can actually trigger an inflammatory response. And also there's a ton of enzymes in the body that break down RNA very readily. You actually have RNA digesting enzymes on your skin. And so to get RNA into a cell, what Moderna is doing is effectively they're encasing the RNA in what amounts to an oil bubble. These are phospholipids. And it's basically the same stuff that the cell membrane is made out of. And so they inject these, they put the mRNA inside the bubble, and then they put the bubbles, they inject that into the muscle, and then those bubbles fuse with the cell, inject the RNA into the cell's cytoplasm, and then there the cell will read the instructions of the RNA and start manufacturing the spike protein. And then once the spike protein is made, the cell will either embed it on its surface or will secrete it outside into the luminal space. Either way, the immune system can then start to building an immune response. And so by using this process, the vaccine doesn't just imitate the structure of the virus, it's imitating the function. And the logic is that this could potentially lead to a more robust immune response than a conventional structural vaccine. Finally, one thing that sets apart the vaccine effort for COVID-19 compared to others is that we're dealing with a pandemic, not just an outbreak. We're talking about a generalized risk where vast majority of people around the world remain vulnerable to it. The virus is already spread around the world, and we need a global effort to contain it, which means we need to get just about everyone in the world. That means we need scale. Remember what I said earlier about how vaccines protect individuals and they protect populations. This is a key reason why we need to start thinking on the order of billions with a COVID-19 vaccine and why the infrastructure and logistics are so important. Think about how we administer other vaccines, things like for childhood illnesses, like measles. We tend to immunize children and babies because they're the fresh incoming people, but that's a much smaller subset of the population than every adult and every child. And so that's why COVID-19 is going to be orders of magnitude much more complicated because we're doing something on such a massive scale. And just imagine making 7 billion of anything, let alone something as complicated as a vaccine. And I think you pretty much get the idea of why this is going to be so enormously difficult. And so then that leads into what are some of the potential emerging storylines and some of the things to pay attention to in the coming weeks. One thing to remember is just that there's no guarantee that any vaccine will ever clear clinical trials. We're very optimistic. What scientists have seen so far has been very promising, but again, no guarantee. There's dozens of viruses that we've been trying to vaccinate against for decades and still haven't succeeded. And I haven't seen much on reporting on how we would cope with such a scenario. And I think that's worth investigating a little bit further. And I touched on this earlier, but yes, how well we do in terms of containing transmission now yields dividends for how well a vaccination effort will work. The fewer cases we have when a vaccine is available, the fewer amount of vaccinations we will need to start containing the pandemic. And conversely, if there is a rampant outbreak that's uncontrolled, we could very easily shoot past whatever the threshold is for herd immunity. Herd immunity is not a magic stop pandemic threshold. I mean, we could easily get up to 70 to 80% infected if we don't do a good job of containing the spread of the virus. And then finally, the scale of the endeavor will bring its own challenges, namely how we build and distribute, administer, and pay for vaccines on a global scale. There may be shortages of vials, syringes, and freezers. Remember all the shortfalls with PPE and testing so far. And then remember that, you know, with these new technologies, with these RNA vaccines and the DNA vaccines, these are things we've never done at scale before. We have technologies for building, you know, structural vaccines all around the world, but we're building these genetic vaccine facilities for the very first time, and we're still learning how to do that. And similarly, many of these vaccines also require, they have very narrow tolerances, so they require things like minus 80 degrees Celsius freezers. UPS, the shipping companies, actually is now installing these freezers in a couple of their hubs. And other, you know, vaccine efforts require things like, you know, inducing an electrical current across skin to help permeate the vaccine. But looking from the bottom up, it seems like there's a big gap in terms of how local governments and how local health facilities will respond to this. These are going to be the front lines of the vaccine distribution effort. And I think there needs to be a lot more reporting and a lot more just research being done on how they're going to come up with the resources to actually do this, given how many constraints they already face and the budget shortfalls they're facing. So these are the things to watch in the coming weeks and months. I'll conclude my presentation here and I'll turn it over to Dan. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, Umair.
This webinar was recorded on Tuesday, September 16th, 2020. We thank the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism for their invitation. And we thank you for listening. Take care.